Muammar al-Gaddafi's regime has reacted to the anti-government demonstrations in Libya with more violence than we've seen in other countries that have been swept up recently in public demands for democracy. He's vowed to die a martyr and refuses to give up power. And today he blamed al-Qaeda for creating the unrest. Dirk van der Waal, associate professor of government at Dartmouth University, joins us now to discuss the Libyan leader's 40-year rule. Professor van der Waal's most recent books are A History of Modern Libya and Libya Since 1969, Gaddafi's Revolution Revisited. He also wrote an op-ed piece for today's New York Times. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Colonel Gaddafi came to power in a coup in 1969. What was the state of the government he overthrew?
Well, Libya since 1951, when it was created really at the behest of the great powers, Libya is truly an artificial country. But since 1951 until 1969, you had a monarchy that was headed by King Idrisa Zanussi. And the Zanussi forces and the Zanussi family had been engaged earlier on during World War II on the side of the British. And so when the country became independent, King Idris became the king of Libya, even though he himself really had very little good to say about a unified Libya. As a matter of fact, he kept talking to the American ambassador that he really didn't want to be king of a united Libya. He wanted to be king of the province of Cyrenaica, where really his ancestors and all his family were.
So the Libya is really a European construct anyway, isn't it? I mean, it was an Italian colony for a long time. And he was being put in charge of this large expanse of land, mostly desert.
Yes, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. Remember that Libya does not really get its name until 1929 when the Italians use it for the first time. But the two provinces, Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, for all practical purposes, had been separated, were somewhat suspicious of each other. There wasn't a lot of interaction. And then, of course, when the kingdom was created, and I should say the kingdom was created in part for the strategic purposes of the United States and Great Britain. Remember, this was the time when we still needed strategic air bases, as they were called, in order to deliver nuclear weapons to the Soviet Union at a time if needed. And Libya just happened to be one of the places where we could have one of those strategic air bases called the Wilos Air Base. And so totally artificially, this country gets created. The king, as I indicated a minute ago, not very inclined to be the king over the entire territory. But then, of course, they discover oil. And that kind of sandbox that you described really becomes a very lucrative enterprise, so to speak. And of course, at that particular point in time, what had been kind of marginal cooperations between the two provinces, as a matter of fact, Libya really had four capitals. It had a capital in Tripoli, it had a capital in Benghazi, it had a winter capital in Al-Baida, and then it had a fourth capital down in the southern part of the country. So a very confusing situation. And of course, when Gaddafi took over in 1969, he truly wanted to make sure that these territories were unified. And what really kept the provinces together until then, between, let's say, 1963, when the federal formula in Libya was abandoned, had, of course, been oil. And it needed the cooperation between the two provinces to bring oil to the Mediterranean. And that really remains the situation until today.
Well, Gaddafi was in his 20s when he assumed power. Did he enjoy wide support?
Well, he was 27 when he took over, and in a sense, there was no wide support for what he always describes as his revolution, but which in a sense was really a coup d'etat. As a matter of fact, when he then very quickly, I mean, first of all, I should say, the monarchy was particularly in Tripolitania not very popular. It was seen as too much pro-Western. It was also seen as highly corrupt. And so that really was kind of the background. But so when Gaddafi then took over, he very quickly found out that all these ideas he had about creating this kind of new state and all the other ideas he had about political parties, etc., really weren't very popular at all. As a matter of fact, Libyans were apathetic more than anything else. And when he found that out, that's exactly when he really started to try to mobilize the country with a number of very forceful interventions into the country's political life, which eventually, of course, having by that time become a dictator, really didn't yield him either what he wanted. But by that time, he could put things down essentially by the security forces that he had created.
Wasn't Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser a role model?
Oh, yes.
Did he want to create a kind of a socialist state of the sort that Nasser had tried to create in Egypt?
Well, there was a slight differentiation in that Nasser was indeed, as you said, kind of a socialist incline. But remember that Libya was still very much a tribal society. And what Gaddafi was really interested in was a kind of a political community that would, in a sense, be a tribe writ large, so to speak, in which all the kind of personal relationships that mark the interaction between individuals and small communities could be extended at the national level. And hence this whole system that he created of popular committees and popular congresses and so on was really to make people participate very directly in the running of the country, as he put it, without the use of intermediaries, meaning without political parties.
Well, so is his socialism simply the nationalization of the oil industry?
Well, I mean, no. I mean, that really came in 1973. But in a sense, it wasn't a kind of an Egyptian-style socialism at all.
Mm-hmm. Libya has a relatively high literacy rate, nearly 82%. Was this an improvement that he made?
Oh, certainly. From the point of view of infrastructure and education, literacy and so on, you can argue that the Gaddafi regime has done moderately well, certainly not as well as compared to some of the countries, for example, in the Arab Gulf and so on. And of course, what underlies a lot of the anger that we're seeing is not so much what has happened to Libya, but what has not happened. And that is, a country that made that much money should have been much farther along. And of course, we know that a lot of that money was wasted on military adventures and all kinds of schemes that really had very little to do with the well-being of Libyan citizens.
And his sons are now reported to be lavish spenders. One of them, Muattasim, has paid Mariah Carey $1 million to sing at a party. He also had Beyonce at another party. He has a lot of sons, and they all seem to be spending a lot of money. So the money's not trickling down to the average citizen?
Well, you know, some of the money trickled down. And you have to remember that 75% of all Libyans in one capacity or another end up working for the government. But it was not compared to what the country made. It certainly wasn't an enormous amount of money. Wages, for example, at some of these state companies were literally frozen for over 20 years. And certainly if you then compare that to the kind of lavish style that the sons were accustomed to, I think you can readily understand why that again provided a ready source of anger against the sons and against the family in general. Now, I must say, one of the sons, of course, Saif al-Islam al-Gaddafi, painted himself as a reformer and wanted to be seen as a reformer.
Until his recent speech, anyway.
Well, yes, exactly. I was going to say until that recent speech, when in effect what it really showed was that you know, he was not in any way different at all from his father. As a matter of fact, he used a lot of the same kind of apocalyptic language that his father had used throughout his 40 years in power. So in a sense, what we saw was a circling of the wagons, but certainly there's no future either for Gaddafi, perhaps at this point, but certainly also not for the son, the would-be reformer.
My guest is Dirk van der Waal, Associate Professor of Government at Dartmouth University, the author of a number of books about Libya, a history of modern Libya, and Libya since 1969, Gaddafi's Revolution Revisited. What's the unemployment rate in Libya?
Well, we don't know exactly. A lot of figures out of Libya you really have to treat with a grain of salt. We know that a lot of young people get checks from the government and effectively do not really work. So the combination of unemployment, underemployment, and people simply who get a check but don't have to go to work must be very high. I mean, and the the evidence we have is perhaps anecdotal, but when I go to Tripoli, for example, or Benghazi, you see a lot of young men, particularly, and young women, just kind of hanging around, you know, playing around with iPhones and all kinds of other gadgets. And those people, you know, when you look at it, those people really should be in the middle of the day doing a job, and obviously they're not. So just based on that kind of anecdotal evidence, I would say that it's probably reasonably high. Remember, this is an oil state. Oil states don't need an enormous amount of their population to participate in the actual running of the economy. And then if you've done like Gaddafi and you've not really diversified much beyond the oil bases, you're really in serious trouble in terms of employment.
But he's also brought in foreign workers. And why are so many of the military now protecting his regime mercenaries? Has he purposely distanced himself from his own military?
Well, the military situation the situation of the military in Libya is quite difficult, and because it is not a truly professional army the way we think about it in the West, or, for example, a professional army that we also saw in Egypt and in Tunisia. The Libyan army has been divided up into a number of brigades and a number of units that have been headed primarily either with closely trusted tribal elites that were also part of the military, or by friends of Gaddafi, or in one case, the 32nd Brigade, actually by one of the sons of Gaddafi, Khamis. So this is not a truly professional military, and hence, by default, the groups that have really been defending Gaddafi have been these security organizations, these militias that he has created since the mid-1970s.
You mentioned young people sitting around. Libya's population is very young, about 70% born after Gaddafi took power. Is there as much access to outside influences and open communication in Libya as there is in Tunisia or Egypt? Are a lot of people on Facebook?
Certainly, the penetration of social media in Libya has been lower than it has been in the surrounding territories. And in part, that has to do also with the fact that, remember, under the Gaddafi regime, English was not really even taught anymore. And so a lot of people, local people, have a very hard time now even speaking English. And it's something, of course, that's penetrated the entire educational system. A lot of my colleagues, for example, that I have to deal with in Libya, simply don't really know enough English to even have a running conversation with a lot of times.
How much do they know about the outside world? I just heard that, according to the state-controlled press, the country is pretty much in a peaceful situation. Tripoli has returned to normal.
Well,
and now he's shouldn't. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, we also shouldn't forget that this is still very much a tribal society. And in tribal societies, news travels very, very quickly. You know, a couple of telephones to family members, you know, spread wide and far very, very quickly. So I think the news is getting around, even though most of the internet sites and the social media sites have really been shut down by the government.
Now, he comes across at times as a buffoon. He keeps on changing his uniforms and, in fact, and his facial hair. He gives wild speeches that make him sound almost paranoid. He just recently said that Al-Qaeda is behind all the problems that he's facing, although I don't know whether Al-Qaeda has played any role in this. He accused five Bulgarian nurses of purposely infecting children at a hospital with HIV. He has those he's accompanied by a group of armed female bodyguards wherever he goes. He's afraid of flying over water. There are all sorts of eccentricities here. Does that not bother people, or has that not bothered people in Libya until now?
Well, remember, this is a dictatorship, or was a dictatorship, and even very small transgressions in Libya could land you or your family in quite serious difficulties. What you found in Libya was that people just simply didn't talk about Gaddafi, or if they did talk about the Gaddafi, they kind of made, you know, a quick reference to the leader, or as he was called. But in general, he was not really a topic of conversation, certainly not with non-Libyans. I'm sure that, you know, certain things were said within the privacy of families. But in general, there was pretty much a sphere of fear And certainly mentioning Gaddafi, as a matter of fact, in all the years I've been in Libya, I've only really heard somebody talk critically of Gaddafi in public maybe one or two times.
So why are we suddenly seeing this explosion? Has this been brewing for a long time, or is this just simply people noticing what's going on in their neighboring countries?
Well, I must admit, even as a long-term observer of Libya, that this was an enormous surprise, because these security apparatuses that Gaddafi has created, the way all these organizations for the protection of the regime were really organized, in my estimation also, really didn't leave much room for any kind of opposition to succeed. But then what we saw was actually very remarkable. We saw popular energy, sparked by the arrest of a human rights lawyer in Benghazi, suddenly assume a proportion that certainly I would never have thought possible, keeping in mind the kind of viciousness of the regime. But it did. And in a sense, it's very ironic. Gaddafi was the one who always talked about people's power. But we've now actually seen people's power in Libya. And it has been the uprising of people who had a lot to lose and who were cowards before and suddenly decided, perhaps inspired by Tunisia, perhaps inspired by Egypt, that enough was enough. And as they started to test those waters during those initial days in Benghazi, it became very clear that the security organizations were not as powerful as everybody had thought, that in a sense the regime could be made to blink. And I think once they realized that, then there really was no going back.
Well, how is he delusional? Because he has been a strong supporter of Pan-Africanism. He proposed himself as the president of the United States of Africa, which was rejected by the other countries. But you have to wonder about somebody who even thinks of himself in that way.
Well, again, the beginning.
You have to tell
here.
Me in 10 seconds, unfortunately.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, this is somebody who's never really been told what his speeches actually sound like, because you can't tell a dictator what he's really doing, or you may end up in jail.
Uh-huh. So he has a lot of sycophants who are telling him that he's doing just great.
Absolutely.
And just one more thing. Is he anti-fundamentalist? How secular is he?
No, he's not completely secular. He is a Muslim himself and a practicing Muslim, but he is against the use of Islam for political purposes.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Professor Dirk van der Waal, Associate Professor of Government at Dartmouth and author of a number of books on Libya. We've been talking about Muammar al-Gaddafi on today's Backstory.
My pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, The New Yorker's John Cassidy examines whether religion is a factor in the lagging economies in many Arab countries. And then the off-Broadway revival of Brian Friel's powerful play Molly Sweeney, about a woman who has an operation to regain her sight. Also, Joydeep Roy Bhattacharya talks about his novel, The Storyteller of Marrakesh. And our latest Please Explain is all about silk. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, Blakeney Schick, and Christina Maldonado. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Andrew Katchen and contributing producers Barbara Kahn and Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.